Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Sometimes just short conversations which you have with your fellow monks give rise to the weekly talk. Just little things which you haven't mentioned before, which you weave into a Dhamma talk, which hopefully will help your meditation and your journey into stillness. We're just talking about ultimate reality today. And to understand, hopefully, that many of you have had a sufficient training in the suttas, in the word of the Buddha, to understand that nowhere in the Pali suttas do we have this idea of like an ultimate reality and a conventional reality. It was something which came a lot later, and it's mostly used by the Mahayana tradition. Because in the Theravada tradition, don't call it Theravada tradition, sorry, call it in the Buddha Vachana tradition, the word of the Buddha, as far as we can tell what the Buddha actually said, was never mentioned that. And instead, what the Buddha really mentioned, which is the start of this little talk and to see where it leads, when he was talking about the three times, past, present and future, and he said, you know, in the past was real. And this present moment and the future were unreal. In the future, that future moment will be real. And this moment and previous moments will be unreal. And right now, the only reality is this present moment. The past and future are unreal. And I like that idea of reality much better than any sort of intellectual, just superficial idea of this reality. Because this is what the Buddha said. As far as your past is concerned, who knows who said what and what they did and why they did it. You only have to look into basic psychology just to know that what we think happened in the past is often not true. All those examples of people who record what they did or what happened, and you actually find out what really happened, and you're so surprised that what you thought you did, you did not do. What you thought you said, you never said, because the mind just bends the past. Every moment we remember it, we bend it one more time. And it's just a given. It's scientifically proved. The evidence is too strong. That what we think happened is totally unreliable. The past is not to be depended upon. In that sense, it is very unreal. And as for the future, we all know that the future is just mere fantasy and projection. And then we can't really tell what's going to happen or what it's like. Or as the Buddha said in the Sapurisa Sutta, mostly in reference to what the experience of jhanas are like, he was saying, whatever you imagine it to be, it will be something else. It's a beautiful saying, which when I first read it in the Pali, stopped me, because that was just true of so many things in life. Whatever I imagine it will be, it will always be something different. What I imagine monastic life would be like, what I imagine being a senior monk is like, what I imagine traveling is like, what I imagine just tomorrow is going to be like. It's never like what I imagine, it's always something different. Which just shows that the future is unreal too. And so the only thing which is real is this present moment. And all the fantasies and dreams and projections, they are unreal as well. And all of the fantasies or suppositions of what someone else said or done, or is doing, all your judgments of other people, that's also unreal. The only reality which you can have is this present moment. And even that you have to sort of look very carefully to sort of take away all of these distortions of perceptions which we add to this present moment. So as far as I'm concerned, ultimate reality is right in this very, very moment. And it's only here that we can find these things. And he just chanted this beautiful Dhamma Chaka Sutta. And the ultimate reality of the present moment, you know, this is, when you talk about ultimate what Nibbana might be like, or what sort of will happen in the future. Just as we said with the jhanas, whatever you imagine it to be, it'll be something else. So that whatever people imagine ultimate reality to be, it's not ultimate reality, it's something else. So people who just try and use their intellect to try and suppose all these things, they're totally missing the point. But in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the reality of now, it's not just knowing this, that every understanding of this present moment, if it's a true understanding, a true seeing of it, it has consequences, it has responsibilities. That's why when the Buddha saw the Four Noble Truths, he said, look, each one of these Noble Truths has responsibilities to it. And that was the saying that the first Noble Truth of suffering, it has to be realized. So it's not just knowing these things just superficially. There is something to do. There's a path to be realized. And there's a truth to be realized there. The truth of dukkha. The truth of everything is being an irritation, being a pain. And of course, that the only way you can know that, as I keep on saying, is that you see these painful experiences disappear from time to time. And since I've been teaching in this monastery, I've always been encouraging people not just to investigate pain, but to investigate pain disappearing, to investigate the opposite of suffering, at least to get some sort of experience of freedom from suffering, you know, in peaceful states of meditation or in jhanas. So you can actually know what suffering is. Without knowing its opposite, you can't know the thing itself. Without leaving the lake, the tadpole can't know what water is. So trying to encourage people to experience some freedom from suffering so they can realize what suffering is. So you may say that the path of Buddhism is, in order to realize suffering, you have to know its escape, its cessation, to know when suffering is gone. And at least get some understanding of that with the deep path of meditation where you feel more peaceful. And it's not just even meditation, just living in a monastery and seeing just all those sufferings, the problems of your life outside this monastery. You know, all the sort of struggles and the strives, trying to get by in life, people criticizing you, people praising you, all of the ups and downs of the life outside. Hopefully in a monastery such as this, you're free from much of that. And when you are free from much of that, don't take it for granted. Realize that, you know, you're free of a whole heap of suffering by coming to stay in here, where you're not judged, you haven't got a career path where you have to sort of strive and struggle and beat other people. You know, unfortunately, there is no sort of political squabble in the kitchen trying to be the head Anagarika. We don't have like elections like we just had in Australia for the head Anagarika for next year, where every sort of Anagarika promises what they will do and everyone votes for who promises the most for next year. So we don't have stuff like that. We're free from so much turmoil and problems. So understand that just being here, there's a lot of freedom from suffering. Realize that. Because sometimes we don't properly realize how we're experiencing life in this very moment. We can take things for granted. We think, oh, it's always like this. It's just like a person who is just recovered from sickness and leaves the hospital. You know, you feel very healthy. You never feel as healthy as when you've just recovered from a sickness. Why? Because you've got something to refer or to compare that feeling of health with, the sickness which has just been passed. And after a while we take that health for granted, which means we don't look after our bodies. It's the same when you just got rid of a great deal of suffering from, like, just coming into this monastery. And all those problems and difficulties with family and people who just don't really understand what you're up to, all that's disappeared. So don't just take it for granted. Realize that this is a freedom from suffering. It's a much more peaceful abiding, where you have more time by yourself and you don't have to relate to other people so much. So there's a great deal of freedom here. Realize that. And as you go deeper into your precepts, just realize just being a good person, being a person who's got who gives fearlessness to other people. You're not going to steal from them. You notice just how some of the people, they come up to the dharamsala, or they just eat outside, they leave their purses and their bags all over the place, because they realize that no one's going to steal from them here. And that's a beautiful thing, that we can give people fearlessness. They know that their goods, their purses, their wallets are going to be quite safe in this place. And even the animals know that they don't need to fear us, so that we can actually watch them and just enjoy their company. And this is a great joy in a monastery, that we give that fearlessness because of our precepts, because of our goodness, and we can trust each other. I never forget, you know, probably one of my best lay friends who I grew up with. You know, I went to Boy Scout Cubs with, and just went to school with this guy, and just still keep in touch with him. When he came to visit me in the monastery in Thailand many, many years ago, it must be about 30 years ago, even more than that, 32, 33 years ago, he came to visit me. And the first day there, he came in the afternoon, and I showed him around, and he asked what happens, and I said, well, one of the highlights of a stay in this monastery is getting up early in the morning and coming on alms round at dawn. Just as the sun comes up, just when the first light, the monks go on this silent walk through the villages, and the villages put just, you know, a piece of rice in each monk's bowl, maybe a banana if you're lucky, but it's a beautiful walk in the early morning, seeing this centuries old, thousands of years old ceremony of alms round. And he said to me, he said, but I can't wake up that time in the morning, you know, I'm a lay person. And I told him that I'll wake him up. I said, I'll be there just before we go on alms round, 2 or 3 minutes before, knock on your door, which I did the following day. And he enjoyed that walk, as many people did do in those days. It was peaceful, it was cool, and it was wonderful to see the sun come up over the paddy fields of northeast Thailand, and see these ancient villagers just squatting by the side of the road, you know, with the dog sitting next to them, hoping they may drop some rice, which they usually did anyway. It was a beautiful time in the morning. And on the walk back, he said to me, it's a very strange feeling that night. And the feeling was strange because he said, I knew you would knock on my door that time in the morning. I said, what's strange about that? He said, look, I live in London. People promise all sorts of things and they don't deliver. And he said, it was strange, because I knew you would deliver, because you're a monk and you're honest. And I remember that experience, because it revealed to me just the precepts which we keep, the fact we can trust each other, we don't lie to each other. And if someone makes a promise, we try really hard to keep that promise. And that's rare in the world. And it creates us so much freedom from suffering when we can trust one another. And don't believe that happens out there in the big bad world. So it's a great sense of freedom from suffering. So we realize that here. And this is a present moment thing. This is not some intellectual fancy of what ultimate reality is. This is the reality of this moment, which you can see for yourself right now. And it shows you that some degree of suffering is disappearing. And it shows you just the power, the sheer power of virtuous living to overcome suffering. And just overcoming that much should make you very delighted, just staying in a good monastery where the precepts are kept, you know, with good friends. Because that just does not exist out there. You're very lucky to find people you can trust. Sometimes even your relations you can't trust. I still remember this fellow he's a very old man, but in those early days when I came to Perth, would help driving us around, and he came and he said he was devastated one day. And I said, what happened? He said, you know, my mother died, father died a long time ago. And, you know, instead of having a will, I decided with my two sisters, I would just go to mother's house the following morning at 8 o'clock and we'd just share out the furniture and other stuff. You know, we're family. And he got there at 8 o'clock. His two sisters had been there 7 o'clock and 6 o'clock and taken all the best things. And he was absolutely disgusted. These are my sisters. We grew up together. And they're just so greedy. And they don't sort of keep their promises. And this is our mother. And they go up there, you know, earlier than me. They've deceived me. I think he didn't even take anything. He just left in disgust. And that's just, you know, your family doing such things. So it's very tough when people don't keep their precepts, and just having just the inspiration of knowing that you can trust people in this monastery. Yes, sometimes they don't show up because they've overslept, or, you know, they don't mean it. It's just sometimes they forget, or they're in jhana or something. You know, maybe the other type of jhanas, you know, the sleepy jhanas, which is not the real jhanas. But you know what I mean, that sometimes the people have got the goodwill, but sometimes they just forget. But at least you can trust people here. And having that sort of realization, I call that an ultimate reality. A real ultimate reality, the reality of goodness, which you can feel, you can touch. It's in this present moment. It's not a fantasy sometime in the future when I become enlightened, this is what it's going to be like. No, keep it right now in the here and the now, in the present moment, something you can experience for yourself. And this is actually more like what I understand as a Dhamma, you know, which is an ultimate reality right now. But you go obviously deeper than that, you know, the second noble truth where the Buddha was saying, this craving which leads to rebirth, it needs to be abandoned. You know, pahatabang. And that's a beautiful sort of teaching there. It shows when you do see in this present moment, you know, you do have craving. And it's just part of just, you know, being a putuchana, even being a stream winner or a once returner. You know, even an anagami has a craving for those immaterial and material states of jhanas. But, you know, here we are, you know, with these cravings, at least be realistic about them. Know them for what they truly are. So once you know what they are, that is a reality for you. And of course, we all know unless we actually accept where we are, we cannot make any progress at all on this path. You have to have some honesty, first of all. And that's very hard for people to have that honesty. Now, sometimes it's much easier just to fantasize on what it would be like to be enlightened. Sometimes it's much easier just instead of facing to the cravings and just to hide them just by just escaping from them. But no, look, understand them, accept them, know them, learn from them, because these cravings, just like Mara, they are defeated not by running away from them, not even by fighting them. It's by another middle way. And fighting them is one extreme, running away is another extreme, and the other middle way is just knowing them, standing one's ground and just knowing these things. So the only way you can know these things is actually be here when these cravings actually happen. To be here, not to be upset or be embarrassed by them or ashamed by them, to know them, experience them, contemplate them, to know what they truly are. And when you can really sort of get right into them, I don't mean sort of indulging in them, but sort of finding out where they're coming from, what they are, where they lead to. As the Buddha said, you know, to know their pleasure, to know the pleasure of craving, their asada, but also to know their danger, what it does to you. You know, how you feel afterwards and how it sort of spoils the rest of the day and then maybe the whole sort of evening. So know their danger and know their escape. The escape comes from knowing these things and pahatabang, to letting them go. Then we know how to do that from that third noble truth, because that third noble truth is to be realized. So, you know, when you have a craving, we know that that's your reality, but the reality comes with a responsibility too. It's not a thing we just know. Responsibility is to know them that deeply, understand them, contemplate them, until you can really say, Mara, I know you. And you understand that the knowing has been done, has been achieved, you've understood it when it disappears. This is a great teaching of Buddhism, that to overcome these defilements, to overcome the problems, to overcome the barrier which separates you from freedom from happiness, freedom from suffering, is actually done through this knowing, clear understanding, without sort of the hindrances, without sort of perception being bent, seeing things what they really are, yathābhūta, jñāna-dasana, seeing things as they truly are. And that becomes reality. And of course, what do you see? You know, you see just these cravings, where they've arisen from, the bad habits of mind. the habit of reacting to the suffering of life by thinking, well, if I try harder to get something in the future, if I crave more, then my craving right now will get less. It's trying to fight craving with craving, like fighting fire with fire, and it doesn't really work. So instead of fighting fire with fire, we just use another method. You know, we just let it burn out. So it doesn't sort of go anywhere. So we put fire breaks around our mind. Those fire breaks are the precepts. So they can't go very far. And so it just burns out, and we make sure we reduce the fuel. And reduce the fuel of the fire by having a sense of restraint, so we don't have much to crave. You know, when there's a beautiful girl or boy comes in this monastery, we keep our eyes down. You know, we don't sort of look for indulgent things. We don't look at sort of movies and TV and other sort of stuff. We try and restrain our senses. That's like fuel reduction for our mind. Which means that it gets quite easy to reduce the cravings. And again, we realize that the escape from cravings, you know, is just, a lot of the escape is actually from the peace and stillness of the mind. As the Buddha often said, that just once one experiences, at least the jhanas anyway, those cravings, they can't really sort of grab you so much, especially the lustful type of cravings. You just got another pleasure, another happiness. And again, that's one of the reasons why we really encourage more and more meditation until you do get the piti sukha of stillness coming up. Maybe it doesn't go as far as jhanas, but at least you get enough piti sukha, there's enough inner joy and happiness that you don't need any of these pleasures anymore. You know, you much more prefer just to have just an opportunity to be in your hut, still, alone, by yourself. And just rather than just sex or movies or anything else. And when you get to that sort of stage, which is not that deep in meditation, a beautiful, delightful breath, then you don't need all these cravings. And that's why we sort of encourage that as a sort of a counterbalance to the need to crave. Because again, the craving is just very often just a reaction to the unpleasantness of life. I'm not talking about the great sufferings when you have a bad headache, or you've broken your leg, or you're dying of cancer, whatever. I'm talking about the average suffering of every day, just the boredom, so the frustration, just the aches, the groans, sort of sleepiness in the morning, whatever else it is that negativity, that little indigestion, or whatever else is a niggling little pain in life. It's usually those types of suffering is the cause of the cravings. It's just an escape. Some place to go so I don't have to endure this nagging ache of life. And of course you do that for so long and you realize the nagging ache of life just continues. It doesn't disappear at all. But you get some nice meditation. It does actually do something to that. It totally abandons it. So you realize that is the way to overcome these things. And so, you do learn how to overcome craving through this way. You know, you understand this present moment. If there is a problem there, you know what to do with it. So the reality is just knowing this moment and knowing what one should be doing with this moment. To me, that is sati sampajanya. Sati is the mindfulness which knows, and sampajanya is the wisdom, knowing one's responsibilities, how one reacts to the problems and difficulties of life, to create peace and to go on the path to enlightenment. When I say this, I mean how to react. You may think it means a doing. And I was talking to our visitors today that because, I know my Pali and I love chanting in Pali. And yesterday when we were doing the Patimokkha chanting, I was listening to the chanting by Ajahn Bhamari, but also just noticing some of the words. And I've listened to that Patimokkha for the last 36 years, every fortnight. But you always actually hear something new. And it's the first time I've heard this rule so many times, the 10th Nisargiya Paditya. You know, you realize that they use the word Vyama. And they used it in the sense, this is like effort. Sama Vyama is right effort. The Vyama is the word used for effort in the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Buddha was saying in the Tetanisakya Paditya that if the layperson, if the attendant hasn't actually given you the robe after you've made hints for 3 times, you can stand in silence for 3 times. And if you stand an extra time, he said, that's called Vayama. That's making more effort. If you do more Vayama than that, it's your offence in the Nisagya Pajitya. And it was one of those times I saw the Buddha using the word Vayama, effort, relating to standing in silence. And I realized that this Vayama is not always struggling. It's not always doing something. Sometimes it is a standing in silence, because to get to that point where you can stand, where you can be started, takes that little bit of effort. But once you're there, you're still. That also counts as Vayama, as an effort. And that's basically just what the Third Noble Truth meant about, you know, to know that suffering and to know how to overcome that suffering. So the ultimate reality of this moment you're experiencing right now, so if you see any craving, it has to be let go of. But how does it be let go of? And I've been teaching for such a long time now about the 4 ways of letting go, which are right there in that Third Noble Truth. To realize that Third Noble Truth is all about using no expectations, achaga, giving, expecting nothing back in return, and learning how to renounce, to throw things away, to realizing throwing things away, to realizing just that contentment called freedom, to realizing anaya, when nothing sticks to you, to realize those states, to realize what those words mean, to use those words as signposts and follow those signposts to where they're pointing and see that destination, to understand those words as a reality, as an experience, rather than as a name. And there you're really getting to a deep ultimate reality. Now, the reality in this very moment of what it means to be aware with no expectations. So you're right here, right now. You don't have to be in jhana to do this. You can be tired. You can be sick. You can just be in a sort of a weird, restless state. But you can be aware of this state and have chaga and have no expectations at all. Just giving your mindfulness to this state and not expecting the stupid mind to get clever. To be totally at peace with it. To realize what that means. That's an ultimate reality. You can actually know what it means to let things go. You're watching there and there is some attachments, there's some cravings, there's some wanting. And you can see just your mind jettisoning it. Just like you're throwing things out of the car. You can see that happening. And you can see what this patinisaga, this abandoning, truly is. And once you actually realize what these things actually are, and you realize that just once you've thrown away this little thing you've been holding on to, and it's so freeing, so liberating, so peaceful, so joyful, you need to get into the habit of this. You throw away one thing, wow, this is good, let's see what else I can throw away. It becomes this, we'll call it obsession, but it becomes this practice which you really start to enjoy and you want more and more of, simply because throwing things away leads to peace. And in this moment, not in the future, not in the past, you can actually see throwing away happening. Throwing away the external things and then throwing away the internal things as well. Throwing away all those things which you take yourself to be. Throwing away your reputation. Throwing away your pride. Throwing away all of your knowledge on all of the things you think you are. Throwing away all your aspirations. Throwing away everything. Throwing away your will, throwing away your consciousness, the whole works, seeing everything just vanish and disappear. Now that's the realization of the asachi katang, to be realized what those things actually are and see how they work. And this is actually a reality, not a theory, because you do this in this present moment And you can do this at any time. There's always something you can let go of. There's some that you can throw away. Every moment of your conscious experience is something which you cling on to, which you can let go of, and you can see that process. And realizing that process, you don't go the whole hog yet. Realizing that process, it means that process starts to build up steam. As it builds up steam, the process almost becomes automatic. You become someone who just wants to give away things. I don't just mean your material things, I mean other things as well. You're someone who doesn't like accumulating things. Your possessions get less and less, not more and more. And not just your physical possessions, but your spiritual possessions as well. That's why all these people who say they're stream winners, once returners, non-returners, arahats, bodhisattvas, this, that, those are spiritual possessions. Those aren't sort of monks or nuns, they're not sort of people on the path, they're just people who just start to possess more and more things. The spiritual materialists, you know, the people who haven't got a clue what this path is all about. It's not about becoming enlightened, it's about not becoming. It's not being, letting go, disappearing, vanishing. Until you realize, yeah, that's what people call enlightenment. But, you know, inside you realize that just that's how people call those things. They haven't got much of a clue what it truly is. It's just disappearing, vanishing, going, till there's nothing left at all. So anyway, this is one what realizes, and one realizes what it means to be content. This mutti, to be free. And so here you are in this moment, and is this moment a prison or is it freedom for you? And you all know that story, which I won't repeat it here. The difference between freedom and being in prison is whether you want to be here or whether you want to be somewhere else. Craving again. Craving creates a prison. Letting go, being content, is freedom. And you realize that. And it's a beautiful path of meditation. In this moment, right now, wherever you are, at any moment of your day, ask yourself, do I want to be here or do I want to be somewhere else? And there's 99% of your day, probably more, you always want to be somewhere else. And that is the problem of life. Very few people want to be here. We always want to be somewhere else. Very few people are at peace with themselves. They want to be different. They always want to change things, build things, make things, clean things, anything, rather than just be here, content, at peace. I know that sometimes people think, oh, if you're content and at peace, nothing will ever happen in the world, we won't achieve anything. Oh, brilliant, great. We've achieved too much already. We've made too much of a mess of this world and a mess of ourselves. How about letting go for a while and just being still? So you practice that, you realize that. You make being content a reality. Not just a thought, not something which you just write about in a magazine or in your diary. But contentment becomes your reality in this moment. Just totally content. Not a fault-finding speck anywhere in your mind. This is just totally good enough. Here I am, and I'm happy to be here. I don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world rather than right here. And straight away, all restlessness is cut off for you. Cut off at the root, made like a palm stump. In this moment it just cannot arise, simply because contentment stops restlessness. Restlessness, wanting to be somewhere else. Contentment is just being here. And of course with that contentment you're also cutting off craving. Craving is wanting to be somewhere else, and not wanting to be here. When you're right here in this moment, totally content, I mean fully content, not playing around, not wanting to be content, but being content. If you can really do that, it's a realization of a truth, and a very powerful truth. This is why I call it one of the ultimate truths. Of total contentment in this moment. And I do that in my cave. You sit there, totally content in this moment. And you don't start off in jhana. You really start off with this aching old body. Those of you who've been my attendants, you know sometimes just after the meal, you've been sitting there since 10:30 or beforehand. People talk to you, you get up and it's stiff and you groan. I've got an old body now. It's a groany body. So I don't sort of start, you know, when I start meditating, you've got this aching, groany body. It takes a while for it to sort of disappear. So you don't start in jhana, but you learn how to be content with an achy, groany, painful old body, which is falling apart. So you learn how to be content with that, to allow it to be, just to be here. This is good enough. I'm just really, really happy just to be here with this aching old body. That degree of contentment, gives you so much peace. Sometimes when I'm meditating, I lose my contentment. I just, you know what it's like. I said, oh, you're getting somewhere now. Come on, let's get a bit further. Stupid, fool. Be content. Don't want to go anywhere. So I remember that. Because I realize, I understand what contentment truly means. And I realize it's not just the goal of this path, it's the path itself is contentment. Contentment leads to stillness. So I understand that as a reality. And to me, that's one of the ultimate realities, contentment. Contentment is something which I know. It's an old friend. Sometimes I miss her. But when I get into that contentment, it's beautiful. And you maintain it, and it just takes off. You just have so much bliss, so much wonderful time with contentment. It's a reality which you know. Not some sort of philosophical, metaphysical statement, but it's a simple realization in this moment, an experiential reality, which takes you into such deep states of peace and stillness, which is part of the path. The Buddha said to realize these things. And of course you realize this mind which nothing sticks to at all. It's Teflon mind. You use all these words, and I like making up new words. Like most monks make up new words, because all they're doing, you know, every sort of teacher who teaches meditation, who teaches Dharma, they use different words because they're talking about the same thing, they're just describing it in their language. You're trying to use new similes. Use new similes of just how to let go. I'm just remembering today that great sort of simile of the Buddha. If you haven't heard it now, here it comes. So not of Ajahn Chah, first year at monastery in Wat Pa Phong. And he always used to say this little piece of advice, his simile, which he kept on repeating, only for the first year, and then he dropped it, he forgot about it, went out of his mind, but never went out of my mind. The story of the Wat Pa Phong being the mango orchard, and all the trees were planted by the Buddha, and the mangoes are dripping from those mango trees, they're ripe, they're sweet. And you monks are so lucky, you don't have to climb the tree or throw sticks up. All you need to do is to sit under that tree and just open your hand and a mango will fall into it. It's one of the most beautiful similes of Ajahn Chah. So I like to teach in the Ajahn Chah tradition of sitting under the mango tree, not shaking the tree, not climbing up it, not throwing sticks, not doing all this stuff, not craving, not wanting to be somewhere other than you are, just opening that door of your heart, opening your hand, freeing the grasping, and just the mangoes just fall in with that beautiful contentment. Just content to sit here. When the mango falls, that's fine by me. If it doesn't fall, that's fine by me. It falls right in the center of your hand when you have that attitude for long enough. And to me, now that's a reality. One of the great expressions of an ultimate reality, of this beautiful idea of stillness, of not interfering, being content, a great expression of the Third Noble Truth. You know, how it works. Letting go of craving leads to nibbana. Letting go of shaking the tree leads to the mangoes falling, rather than the other way around. And so one realizes this, and it means there has to be like an effort there, a wayama, and that is actually to be still. Just like in the 10th Nisakya Pajitya, the effort, having tried to hint to your attendant, to stand in silence in front of him. No more effort than that. Except if he doesn't give it to you, then you have to go to the donor and tell them that the attendant's not doing their job. But it's a nice expression of wayama, of being still. And so one realizes this is an ultimate reality of contentment leading to stillness. And when one practices like that third noble truth, you do actually start to see that from things like having no expectations, from throwing things away, from being content and nothing sticking to you, you find that things actually cease, they vanish. And these are the experiences, again in this moment, right here, right now, in your own body and mind. You see these things vanishing, and these are experiences of that third noble truth. You're actually realizing cessation, nirodha. That's what nirodha means, things cease. And that's a beautiful experience, because you're realizing that you are experiencing the path of a Buddha. This is what happens, and it's your experience now. It's no longer theory, it's no longer some historical anomaly. You know, maybe in the time of the Buddha these things happen, they can't happen today, but you're actually realizing it for yourself in this very life. You are doing this. You're experiencing it. It's happening. You see, things actually cease. They stop. They finish. You see sort of past and future going. And that's a cessation, and that's an important cessation. You're just in this moment, all your memories of the past, your memories of the future, just are not there. You can see this thinking vanish. You're sitting there and you're not verbalizing anymore. You're not giving things names. Please understand that that's a powerful cessation. Even in the Sanyutta Nikaya, in the Citta Sanyutta, where Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, said it's impossible to stop thinking. It's like trying to stop the Ganges with putting your fist in the river. It can't be done, he said. And so that's how little Mahavira knew. And you're actually doing it. You're stopping thinking. It's just there, poised in this moment. With the mind not moving into thoughts. Still, just perceiving. Perceiving the breath going in, breath go out. But not saying anything. Wow, that's cool. You're realizing a cessation there. And these things happen not because you try. That's what Mahavira didn't understand. You can't try to do this. It just happens when you stop trying. It happens when you're content. When there's nothing to say. There's nothing to think. You're just aware in this moment. You're just aware of just all the body disappearing and just the breath being there. It's great to be able to do that, because sometimes when the body disappears, obviously one doesn't know it's disappearing. Because, you know, one is not aware of the body. One's just aware of the breath. It's just every now and again when you're watching the breath, sometimes you think, my God, the body's gone. I can't feel my hands. I can't feel my feet. But very often when you do that, the body comes back again. But just beforehand, realize that the body had vanished. At least most of it had. What a beautiful thing that is. So many people love to transcend this body. As I say, my body's getting old and achy. But it's great when I'm in meditation. In meditation, I can't feel this achy old body. It's not hot, it's not cold. Still got an itchy nose. That disappears when you're meditating, because you can't feel your nose. You don't have a clue what's going on. It's just so beautiful when you're just free from this body. And when it happens to you, just watching the breath go in and go out, it's usually the state of the delightful breath. That means it's delightful because something has vanished, which is a big burden, and that's the rest of your body. You're realizing a cessation. You're getting insight to what cessation actually means. Not as a sort of an inference, but as an experience. This is cessation happening. Body's gone. And you've just got the breath. And then the breath goes. You're experiencing. At that point, just if you're wise enough, you've got enough experience, and you sort of, your mindfulness is strong enough, you know your whole body, your five senses are stopped. Beautiful. Things have ceased, they've vanished. You're realizing this third noble truth. This is a reality which a lot of people, they just think is impossible. To be able to sit here and not have any hearing, smelling, tasting, not even feeling the body. Perfectly aware. Inside, but not percipient of the five senses. And that's a realization. You're there, you're experiencing it. And that is a beautiful reality. It shows you that this body and its five senses is of the nature to arise, therefore it's of the nature to cease. Said in the Dhammacakka Sutta, Yan Kinchi Samudaya Dhammang Sabantang Niroda Dhammanti. What is of the nature to arise? All of that is of a nature to cease. You're seeing this body ceased. It's the nature to arise, now it's gone. You just left with this beautiful mind. And then you start to see that vanish. You start to see that Niroda. You start to see, as I say, the will disappearing, the consciousness vanishing in the jhanas. And these are realizations. Now to me, this is reality. The reality of cessation, the realization of a lot of the Third Noble Truth. Seeing these things happen, experiencing them, and seeing that the will, the nature to arise, is the nature to cease. Not just to change, but to cease, to stop. So seeing the chetana, the choice, the one in control, is of the nature to cease. And you realizing that cessation, the ultimate reality of cessation of will, is there. You're with it. It's not a theory, an experience. Now you're getting somewhere. And then seeing consciousness vanish. Even consciousness, the jitta, the mind, which is of a nature to arise, all of that is a nature to cease. And that is ultimate reality. And if you see that fully, you can call yourself a stream winner. Because you know there's nothing left. That's why in that Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, that's why Kondaniya said he was a stream winner. That's how you know all that which is of a nature to arise. The five khandhas, the body, the mind, the will, the consciousness, all that which is of a nature to arise. Is a nature to cease, and now it's ceasing, and you're there experiencing it ceasing. You're realizing it, which is your job in the Third Noble Truth. And that's a powerful, powerful reality, probably the most ultimate of the ultimate realities. Again, not a theory, but it's just what happens. And of course, this is why this happens in this moment, not in the future. It's not a theory, it's not something you write about. Is something which you know, experience, which is your reality. And so all this job about the ultimate reality being this and the ultimate reality being that, it's not what you talk to each other about, it's not what you debate, it's not what you argue, it's not what you hit each other over the head with, my ultimate reality against your ultimate reality. It's that which we realize in these deep meditations, which you realize in your heart alone, by yourself, deep in stillness. It's not that hard to do. And of course, how do you do it? You just practice this Eightfold Path. So even that path is a reality. And you might even say, well, the goals, maybe you're not on the goal yet. You don't actually know really where this thing is leading to because you haven't experienced it. Remember what I said, even though I describe it again and again, whatever you imagine it to be, it's going to be something different. Even right now, what you imagine this all to be, from my description, it's not like that at all. Can't be. It has to be different. Just I give the best description I can do. But it's only a signpost, not the reality itself. So it's your job, as the Buddha said when he described ultimate reality. Buddha's only point in the way. Now it's up to you to walk that path. So that path is that Fourth Noble Truth. To be practiced by way to bang. That's our reality. That's what we have to do. So it's not just a case of arguing with each other or being philosophers. It's being practitioners. So it's not so much what we think or what we say, but how we say it, how we think it, how we do it. And that's all part of the Eightfold Path. To make sure that we have a basic understanding of what Buddhism is with the right view. At least to understand that the problem is with rebirth. The fact that you will get reborn if you don't stop this craving business. To know, to realize that, you know, the Buddha did say this, it's how he taught. And the five khandhas, this process which leads to rebirth. And just how this whole process, we take it to be a me, to be a mind, to be a self. And how that causes the craving. When there's someone in here, there's someone to do the craving. If there's no one in here, and you know that as a realization, not as a theory, but as a reality, of course, craving can't sort of exist anymore. There's no one in here to do anything. It's just like my simile of the hand. You cut the hand off and you can't do any grasping. But there's no self in here. There's nothing to do anything. No one, nothing to grab anything. So letting go happens and nothing else can happen. So this is how we realize and understand these things. With at least a bit of a right view, at least have some confidence and faith that what the Buddha actually said in the suttas is the truth. And as I say, don't follow any ajahn, don't follow any teacher. Follow the Buddha. Please don't follow me. So it's not what Ajahn Brahm says, it's what the Buddha says. And whatever I say is only are valid in as far as it further explains what the Buddha says in the suttas. So please have the faith in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, not in a person, not in sort of a teacher, not in an ajahn, because that's very, very dangerous. So have that faith in that, and then one, the rest of the Eightfold Path, just, you know, the right intention, again, straight from the Third Noble Truth, to renounce nekama, to be kind, to be gentle. All about letting go, being content. It's what we do. Keep your precepts. Be restrained in your speech, in your actions, in your livelihood. Because the way you speak to each other, what you actually do, it's not insignificant. It's right there. It's, there you've got three factors, three eighths of the Eightfold Path. It's just this speech and this action. So it's important. And you know, learn what this Vayama is. The effort of stillness, just standing there in front of your mind. Just like one's supposed to stand in front of the attendant. Just standing. Not moving, not saying, just standing. See what happens then. And as I said before, seeing the mindfulness actually grow as a power. Not something you make, but something which grows according to its causes. Know what the causes of mindfulness are, and it's not will. Will is not the cause for mindfulness. Stillness is the cause for mindfulness. It grows and grows and grows. And of course, mindfulness is the cause also for stillness. Letting go, making peace. And with that samadhi, you're realizing these Four Noble Truths. And as far as I'm concerned, my experience, the greatest reality is in the deep meditations. The books only point to that reality. The books are the containers. The words are the containers. And all, even the Four Noble Truths is a container. It contains that stillness, that disappearing, that vanishing, that nibbana. So that is the reality for me when things disappear. That's why, that's my refuge. That's what keeps me going. Be able to go to my heart, sit and see things vanish and disappear. Bliss without boundary. So, ultimate reality. Not sort of something which you argue about, but something you realize. Right in this moment, right now. This is real, because you can experience it. So that's the talk this evening on Ultimate Reality.
So, Supatipano Bhagavato.